Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, in moments, Bruce Dixon of the Black Agenda Report will tell us about the background of our new Attorney General, Loretta Lynch. And at the bottom of the hour, Sean Jacobs analyzes the recent wave of xenophobic attacks on immigrants in South Africa. Before that, a few words on Hillary Clinton. I become something of an anti-Hillary industry after having written the Stop Hillary cover story in the September 2014 issue of Harper's Magazine. More recently, I've got a piece in the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee on the Al Jazeera America website that went up about 10 days ago, and an interview about her in Salon that went up on Thursday morning. It also looks like I'll be expanding the Harper's piece into a little polemical book that should appear later this year. I should say that while this is all a lot of fun, I think that Hillary and her husband are terrible people, I do want to step back from personalizing my antipathy to her and Bill too much. Being money-grubbing servants of people even richer than they are is hardly unusual in politics, though they're particularly accomplished masters of the role. I think it's fair to say they've moved from being servants of the ruling class to being full-fledged members. The born-again populist Hillary is reportedly planning to raise about $1 billion for her presidential campaign. What about the candidate that comes with that billion-dollar price tag? The case for Hillary is remarkably thin, which is probably why many Democrats get so annoyed when you question it. The three points in her favor are, she's a woman, she's experienced, and it's her turn. Let's consider these three points. First, her gender. Yes, Hillary is undeniably a woman, and it is undeniably embarrassing that the United States has been led by nothing but men, many of them remarkably undistinguished. But her being a woman tells us nothing about her politics. It feels achingly obvious to point out that Margaret Thatcher was a woman, and few Hillary enthusiasts would consider themselves supporters of the Iron Lady. Second, experience. What does this consist of? Early in her husband's presidency, she ran his health care reform campaign. It was a total disaster. She ran it under a shroud of secrecy and consulted with almost no one outside her inner circle. The giant egos that populate Congress were annoyed by her high-handed manner, and the plan died without even so much as a vote. The secrecy and high-handedness are recurrent features of her political life. She hates the press and recoils from public scrutiny. To students of Hillary's political life, the current email scandal is just the latest iteration of a pattern of many decades. A senator from New York, she did very little of substance, though she did vote for the invasion of Iraq. And as Secretary of State, she traveled a lot, but it would be very difficult to name a single accomplishment of her tenure. I doubt she would have negotiated the Iran deal the way her successor John Kerry did. And third, it's her turn. This argument strikes me as evidence that the American political culture has become thoroughly, perhaps fatally, sclerotic. A country that looks more and more like a frank plutocracy, with a deeply alienated and atomized population and a rotting social and physical infrastructure, needs something fresher than another Clinton. What might we expect from a Hillary presidency? My guess is that it would be very Wall Street-friendly, militarized, and secretive, though seasoned with mostly empty rhetoric about uplift, community, and inclusion. It would do little to address polarization and rot. In fact, it would be a perfect embodiment of polarization and rot. There will be strenuous efforts over the next year and a half to argue otherwise, but they will convince no one but loyalists. That's not to say she isn't trying. It's amazing to hear her talking critically about inequality and mass incarceration now. It's a measure of the times that she now feels like she has to sound like a hybrid of Michelle Alexander and William Jennings Bryan. But judging by her history, it's all phony. My first guest is Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the excellent and underappreciated Black Agenda Report website. He describes himself in his Twitter bio as an organic gardener, lifelong leftist, former Panther, current Green, troublemaker, organizer. Bruce had a piece on the BAR website the other day about our new Attorney General with the catchy title, Loretta Lynch is Condoleezza Rice with a Law Degree. There was a lot of celebration of Lynch for being the first black woman to serve as the nation's top law enforcement officer, which is an accomplishment in the labor market sense, I suppose, but much less attention was paid to who she is, beyond her race and gender, and what she's done, which is mostly pretty nasty. But such are the ways the black misleadership class, as Bruce Dixon likes to call it. Welcome, Bruce. There's certainly a lot of celebration of the confirmation of Loretta Lynch to be the first black woman to serve as the U.S. Attorney General. You're not joining in the celebration, are you?
Well, I guess not. No, there doesn't seem to be a lot to celebrate. Not really.
Let's talk about her background. What's her past? How'd she get to this position?
Well, she did both her undergrad and her law degree at Harvard. So she's been in the charm circle for a long time now. When she left Harvard, she got a job with a prestigious New York City law firm, and she specialized in keeping white-collar criminals out of jail. That was her original specialty, and giving them tax advice and other advice to keep them on the right side of the law. And from there, she went to the Justice Department. And lo and behold, when she joined the Justice Department, she became an instant expert on white-collar crime and headed up the Justice Department's White-Collar Crime Task Force. And once again, her main expertise in the field of white-collar crime was defending white-collar criminals and keeping white-collar criminals out of jail. So I guess that's how you get to be a white-collar crime specialist nowadays.
It's funny, because I think usually the thing goes the reverse direction. People work as assistant U.S. attorneys, then go to work for law firms defending white-collar criminals, but she reversed the process.
It's not completely uncommon in black politics in America. I live in Atlanta, or near Atlanta, and in Atlanta, Georgia, when the current mayor ran for election, he billed himself as a civil rights attorney. He didn't mention the fact that he was only a civil rights attorney in the sense that he used to work for and defend the corporate violators of civil rights.
Yes, I met an environmental lawyer like that once, yes. Defending polluters, and he called himself an environmental lawyer. How active a prosecutor of white-collar crime was she at the Justice Department?
Well, if you think a prosecutor's job is to negotiate with those accused and offer them, you know, wonderful settlements that are really to their advantage, then she's been very, very active. And that's why she was summoned to the Department of Justice this last time. But in between that time, in between her first time with the Department of Justice, she went back to private practice again and did more white-collar crime law on the private side, of course, defending white-collar criminals. And also she did a stint at the New York Federal Reserve. Eventually she was called back to DOJ. And when she was called back to DOJ this time, she was apparently the federal DA, the head federal DA for the Southern District of New York. No, the Eastern District of New York, which I think is Brooklyn.
Yes, my borough.
Exactly. So she was your DA, Doug. And in that capacity, she prosecuted literally thousands of petty federal drug cases, which is what loads up the drug courts and what sends people to prison for a lot of years for minor offenses that get federalized. That's just the way these things work. And when she left that, like I said, she also spent some time in there, some time where she was called to take part in the International Criminal Justice Tribunal in Rwanda. And Rwanda, the story that we usually get about Rwanda was the one pictured in that movie Hotel Rwanda, where you have the good guys are Tutsis and the bad guys are Hutus, and that those 800,000 people dead was a matter of Hutus killing Tutsis. Well, the truth is it's really not at all that simple, and at least 10% of the dead were done by the current guy who's president, Paul Kagame, who was trained in Fort Leavenworth and some other stuff. Anyway, Loretta Lynch went over there, and she supposedly was an investigator, but she only interviewed the people that Kagame's side brought to her. And some of the same people that were supplying her with people to question are the people who figure heavily in the genocide in neighboring Congo, where 6 million people have died in the last 20 years, and 2 million rapes have occurred.
Now, American elites are very fond of Kagame, right? He's their kind of guy.
Oh, yeah. Even your civil rights workers. I mean, your civil rights, old-fashioned civil rights leaders like Jesse Jackson has appeared at Rwanda Day here in Atlanta and also in Chicago. And essentially what he's doing and what they're doing when they do this is they're giving a green light for black Americans to try to open businesses in Rwanda or befront people for Rwandan businesses or partner with Rwanda's businesses, and in that way give their blessing to and support the extraction of raw materials and everything from neighboring Congo under what can only be described as like genocidal conditions. But apparently Loretta Lynch had one hand in that too. And so now she's back at the Justice Department. The last time that she was called back to the Justice Department was when Obama was swept into office, and you had the hedge fund guys and the banksters and Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, AIG, and all the rest of these crew had crashed the economy. And so there was definitely a need for white-collar criminals to get off. And so Loretta Lynch, it turns out, was one of the people who helped write the fine print on the get-out-of-jail-free cards in the Citigroup settlement. And also, she handed a fat deal to HSBC, which probably should have been broken up. HSBC was one of the bankers to the drug traffic worldwide, and have also been bankers to thousands of corporations and extremely wealthy individuals that move money offshore between God knows where and the so-called legitimate economy.
Now, when she was the DA in Brooklyn, she was a very aggressive prosecutor of minor drug offenses, yet now here she is writing the get-out-of-jail-free card for the major financer of large-scale drug traffickers. That doesn't seem terribly consistent.
Yeah, that's our... it is consistent because you can't have a banking system. You can't have a banking system unless you have ways for this illegitimate money to get back into the regular economy. You're the economist.
that was a bit of false naivete, let me confess.
I know. You know, but and so what Loretta Lynch is doing when she stands up for her white-collar criminal clients and their ability to make special windows, drug lords in certain places that were doing business with HSBC, the regular deposit windows. I mean, I used to drive a taxi cab at night, and I used to drop my money at the bank, you know, my little $40, $50, $150. Well, if you're a drug lord, you've got to deposit a box of money or bags of money every night. So HSBC had special night stations where you could drop off boxes of money. It was kind of ridiculous, but in the spirit of too big to jail, this is what she does. Is she writes the fine print on the get-out-of-jail-free cards. In her, I believe it was the Citigroup settlement that she did, the one that was concerned, among other things, with robo-signing. It was Loretta Lynch that is supposedly responsible for the settlement that precludes state attorneys general from signing on to separate suits against these white-collar criminals. So, you know, this is Loretta. This is who she is and what she is.
So what do we know about what kind of attorney general that she might be coming out of this? I mean, she's made it clear she's certainly no friend of softening the drug laws, right?
That's absolutely true. You can look at who her friends are. They say that a great way of knowing who people are is looking to see who their friends are. Rudy Giuliani lobbied other Republicans off and on for lifting her nomination. So she's a great, great friend of Rudy Giuliani. Also, the current head of the Fraternal Order of Police is a great friend and proponent of Loretta Lynch. So that might give you some idea what we're looking at there. Loretta does not share the opinion that marijuana is only about as harmful as alcohol and that it should be legalized. You know, she still is about the death penalty. She endorses the death penalty also. So this is the kind of lady we're about to have here as Attorney General. She has said that among her first priorities is going to be consoling and comforting and looking out for the morale of the police.
Yeah, well, this is really remarkable. Now, you know, first we had Ferguson and many other things, but now we've got this explosion in Baltimore, and here she is concerned about the morale and prestige of the police.
Well, I guess that's how you get to be Rudy Giuliani's good friend and the Fraternal Order of Peace of Police's good friend. But, you know, this is the state of politics, and this is the state of the blackness leadership class or black political class, whatever you have to call them. I think we really need to get in the habit of looking, when we talk about this black political class, we got to get in the habit of looking beyond just the men and women that stand for public office, who stand for election. We need to be looking at their unelected functionaries. These people are really, really important to the functioning of the way the state goes on right now, and they're black. And the Democratic Party and is really, really, really ready to help us, at least help black people forget about everything except the fact that they're black.
I'm speaking with Bruce Dixon of the Black Agenda Report. You mentioned Holder. What did you think of his tenure as Attorney General?
Holder is actually cut from the same cloth as Loretta. Holder has been also a vicious federal prosecutor for a long time, and he's been a corporate lawyer for a long time. I really haven't looked up his record on defending white-collar criminals, but it was Holder that picked Loretta Lynch to do what she did with Citigroup and to take part in the HSBC negotiations and the rest of them. So they're in the same bed. And the notion that Holder is some kind of, stand-up guy when it comes to reducing the prison population and reducing mass incarceration is just a complete joke. But that just speaks to the kind of press that we've been allowing the Obama administration to give itself. I mean, we always thought it was perfectly ridiculous for the Attorney General, after he'd been in office 2 or 3 years, to come on TV and say, oh, guess what? We just discovered that the police are doing this stuff to black folks more than they're doing it to white folks. And we just discovered that there's an inappropriate number of black and brown people and poor people in prison. Who could have known that? Now, I mean, how can the Attorney General get up and act like they just discovered mass incarceration? Come on.
These people help make it possible.
Exactly. I mean, these people, that's one of the bases for the black political class in this country, quiet as it's kept. If you go back to Michelle Alexander's wonderful book of a few years ago, The New Jim Crow, she says that if we were to roll back incarceration to 1980 levels right now, and the book was published like 5 years ago now, I think, we'd have to let 1 million people out of prison, and there would be almost another million who'd be out of jobs.
Yeah, Bruce, you mentioned the black political class. 50, 60 years ago, there was virtually no such thing. We now have thousands and thousands of elected officials and various functionaries all over the place. What do you say about the politics of that? Have black faces in public places done that much to improve the lot of black Americans?
Well, there's no doubt that they've improved the lot of black Americans who are in those places. And there's no doubt that they've done some good. I would be the last one to say that there's no change, that they've done no good. But institutions are bigger than individuals, and institutions exist to guide and shape and limit and direct what individuals do. And the black political class has become part of the system. They were always part of it. And so right now the black political class is heavily invested in gentrification, in maintaining the prison state and the police state. And that's what Loretta Lynch is part of. When we think of the black political class and the black misleadership class, a lot of times we only think of the elected folks, the Barack Obamas or the Congressional Black Caucus or your local mayor or something. But we need to also think about all those unelected functionaries of corporations and of military and of the state itself and the revolving doors through which they all come. Think of people like Colin Powell. Think of people like Susan Rice, who's a bloody-handed diplomat when Democrats are in power, and a consultant representing the Ethiopian regime or the Ugandan regime or the Kenyan regime when Republicans are in power. And think about Condoleezza Rice on the Republican side of that equation.
Who has an oil tanker named after her, right?
Yeah, that's right. And who can play the piano, unlike Loretta Lynch. I kind of likened them to each other, but I forgot that Condoleezza Rice does at least have one redeeming talent. She does, they say, play the piano really well. But yes, the you've got a Morehouse man, the odious Jay Johnson himself, who's the head of Homeland Security. And then you've got Eric Holder, whose record will, you know, whose hallmark of his career is always going to be when he told us that the big banks were too important to investigate, too powerful to prosecute, too wealthy and influential to jail, and too big to allow to fail. And now his protege, Loretta Lynch, whose fingerprints are all over the HSBC deal that the Justice Department did and the Citigroup deal that the Justice Department has done.
You mentioned gentrification. You know, this is the local level, I guess, you're talking about. Could you talk some more about that? Now, do you see this in Atlanta, for example?
You see that everywhere that African Americans are. You know, one of the things that you'll know about being an African American is that wherever you grew up, if you come back to it 40 years later, it's not likely to be there at all. I was born and raised on the South Side of Chicago, and the South Side of Chicago of the 50s, 60s, and 70s is completely vanished. You know, if Obama and the Dailies and Rahm Emanuel had been allowed to have their Olympics in Chicago, then it would be even more unrecognizable to people of my generation. But it seems that the real estate that poor people, specifically black people, urban black people, inhabit over the last half century has changed in value, and now powerful interests, lucrative interests, want that inner city land. And so everywhere from the five boroughs to Baltimore to Chicago to Atlanta, you've got African Americans being moved off the land and put out there in the suburbs where there are where there's fewer jobs, less transportation, and even less access to what the supposed advantages of living in a modern city are.
Yes, I'm sitting in one of those neighborhoods, Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, so I'm part of the problem there. Now, there are some people who say that the solution to police brutality, for example, is we need more black cops, more black police chiefs, more black attorney generals. Will this cut it?
Well, it's certainly not cutting it now. Look at Baltimore, where people are in the streets now outraged over the latest atrocious case. There is Freddie Gray. Freddie Gray made eye contact with a police lieutenant in a public place and took off running like a rabbit. And the relations of black people, of young black men to the police in the early 20th century are such that the police figure, if he runs like a rabbit, our job is to chase him like hounds. And when the hounds caught up with Freddie Gray, they did what hounds do when they catch up with a rabbit, is they broke his back, severed his spine. And this this as a police story is not even remarkable. If you're a young black man and you make eye contact with a cop and turn around and run, you will be chased, and you may very well get what Freddie Gray got. There wouldn't be crowds in the street if the case of Freddie Gray was not business as usual.
And of course, Baltimore has a black mayor.
And the black police chief, just like New Orleans and Atlanta and so many, many, many other big cities.
So if changing the personnel is not the solution, what is?
Changing the personnel, as you and one of your guests on a recent show pointed out, are part of what they call proceduralism. You know, saying that maybe we can just take the racism out of policing by having more rules. But the fact is, you're not going to take the racism out of policing with just more rules, because the police are the sharp end of the prison state, and they're the point of the spear as far as enforcing a vicious and unequal social order that we have here in the United States. The only cures are going to be doing things that take police out of some of the interactions that they ordinarily have with people. Why is homelessness a police problem? In Atlanta, our mayor, Kasim Reed, one of the first things he said he was going to do, a black mayor, by the way, with a black police chief, The first things he said he was going to do on his first day as mayor was to begin to take what he called, and I'm using his words, a more muscular approach to the problem of the homeless and panhandling in downtown Atlanta. You know, so why are the police taking muscular approaches to homelessness, to mental illness, to petty drug violations and petty traffic violations and interactions with people of all kinds? You've got to take the police out of these situations because they can't handle it, and find some other way to address homelessness, find some other way to address drug problems, and find some other way to address a lot of the things that we now throw police and prisons at.
That was Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the Black Agenda Report. It's on the web at Black Agenda Report, all one word, blackagendareport.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
There's a train that comes from Namibia and Malawi. There's a train that comes from Zambia and Zimbabwe. There's a train that comes from Angola and Mozambique. From Lesotho, from Botswana, from Swaziland, from all the hinterlands of southern and central Africa. This train carries young and old African men who are conscripted to come and work on contract in the gold and mineral mines of Johannesburg and its surrounding metropoli. 16 hours or more a day for almost no pay. Deep, deep, deep down in the belly of the earth, when they are digging and drilling for that shiny, mighty, evasive stone, or when they dish that mishmash mash food into their iron plates with the iron shovel, or when they sit in their stinky, funky, filthy, flea-ridden barracks and hostels, and they think about the loved ones they may never see again, because they might already have been forcibly removed from where they last left them, or wantonly murdered in the dead of night by roving and marauding gangs of no particular origin, we are told. They think about their lands and their herds that were taken away from them with the gun and the bomb and the tear gas and the Gatling and the cannon. And when they hear that choo-choo train, a chugging and a pumping and a smoking and a pushing and a pumping, crying and a steaming and a chicken and a wah, wah, they always curse and they curse the coal train, the coal train that brought them to Johannesburg. Wah,
wah. Oh, some of Stimula by Hugh Masekela. The tale of the trains bringing migrant workers to South Africa is an excellent setup for this interview with Sean Jacobs. Recent weeks have seen some appalling attacks on immigrants to South Africa from elsewhere in the continent. South Africa has enjoyed a reputation abroad as the Rainbow Nation, a reference to its supposed inclusiveness and diversity. The reality is a lot uglier. Immigrant workers following the path that Masekela described in that excerpt from his song find themselves under verbal and physical attack, denounced as parasites, and sometimes burned alive. Why? Here's Sean Jacobs to fill us in. Sean teaches international relations at the New School in Manhattan. He's the founder of the Africa is a Country blog, which, as its about page says, is not about famine, Bono, or Barack Obama. Africa is a Country is about the culture and politics of a continent that doesn't get much serious attention in the fancy parts of the world. Sean Jacobs. So the Rainbow Nation, well, some clouds in the rainbow. What's been happening with this anti-immigrant violence in South Africa in recent weeks?
I mean, first, I think there is no rainbow, right? I mean, the whole, just on that terminology, like the rainbow itself was a myth. It never happened. And there's a way, I think, in which people write about South Africa, which is like, oh my God, there was a rainbow and the rainbow is gone. I mean, I know what they refer to. They're referring to this period in the sort of like the end of apartheid and the sort of optimism that went around with forming a new country. But what people forget is that built into that new nation are a number of, if you want to talk sort of in computer language, like malware. So they're like, there are things in built into the mechanism or the body of the nation that means that have remained unresolved. So for example, one is, and I wrote an article about this in the New York Times last Friday, that build into the idea of South Africanness is a very narrow understanding of South Africa, of who's a South African. Who is a South African? Are those people, blacks and whites, who were party to the conflict that led, you know, the conflict of apartheid, the conflict of colonialism, and then that conflict gets resolved politically at some level, not economically, not socially, but politically. And all other newcomers, they can never become South African. So I think that's part of it. The second thing I think is that this is just a residue of sort of early 1990s, late 1980s, early 1990s political compromises of the ANC, particularly in how they relate to forms of traditional rule. These are sort of very backward, often right-wing, retrogressive type of politics that was associated with Kings Relatini. That's the king that made those xenophobic remarks. And the ANC thought that they had managed to co-opt those people, but they had never dealt with the politics that those people represent. And you saw that the sort of utterances that the Zulu king made, and Zuma, he brought those people back into politics, because when he was campaigning to become president, he utilized sort of tribalist politics, you know, very sort of conservative politics, in his battle with Mbeki to become the president of the ANC. So in a way, it's almost like they're reaping what they sowed, if you want. And so it's that. And then I think finally, there's a way in which this is reflective of these sort of those things as that people used to call the national question in South Africa, those things that remain unresolved, like inequality, the fact that South Africa, it has a government, which is, you know, the people vote for, it's a democratic government, but that government's policies, it's not governing in the interest of the majority of the people. And so 20 years later, there's all this residual anger and disappointment, and people take it out on the people that are closest to them. Migrants, like particularly black African migrants, they don't go live in white neighborhoods, because they're also poor often. They end up living in the townships. And because they often are successful, you know, they come from another place where they've gone through independence a long time ago. They have sets of skills around trades and so on. People, local people, see them now as the problem as to why they don't have a job.
The comment of the Zulu king was that he called them parasitic fleas, or these immigrants?
Mm-hmm. He called them lice and he called them ants.
And the president's son also got involved, right?
Yeah, I mean, Edward Zuma, he's one of the President Zuma's many children. The thing about him is, I think, you know, he's a private citizen. And of course, I'm dismayed at the comments he made. But I think the difference with him and the king is a public figure. How he lives is paid with taxpayer money in South Africa. In fact, of all the sort of traditional authorities in South Africa, and many people don't know, but in the 9 provinces of South Africa, in at least 5 of them, traditional authorities have some form of like govern. They have some, you know, right about or control over how they govern people. And he's one of them. So they paid for by the state. And this is why people are upset. If, you know, there are all kinds of racist and retrograde kinds of people in South Africa. But if they're private citizens, you can perhaps like go with them in front of what's called the Human Rights Commission, or you could make a criminal charge against them. And people have said they would do this against the king. But the difference is that he's a public servant. He's paid with taxes by South African citizens. And I think that's what makes it more of a problem.
Okay, so who's being attacked and who's doing the attacking?
So who's attacking, you know, what people do is they attack foreigners. When they say foreigners in South Africa, they don't mean whites, white immigrants from Europe or North America. They don't mean people from East Asia. Generally, what they mean are black Africans, Africans from elsewhere on the continent. So other languages that people have used is to say that this is not necessarily xenophobia. It is Afrophobia. You have black South Africans attacking other black Africans coming from other parts of the continent. Secondly, it's poor black Africans that are being attacked. So it's like it's not an African who's mobile, who's cosmopolitan, and who can work in banking or teaches university. It's really people at the bottom rung of society, like traders, people who run, you know, a small store, someone who's a tailor. Those are the people that are getting attacked. And then on top of it, there is a perception in South Africa which is not backed up by the facts that new migrants to South Africa take jobs. There is all the statistics suggest, all the research suggests that that's not the case, or that they are primarily involved in crime. Crime is mostly done by South Africans, but in this kind of moments, people focus on foreigners.
And what's the nature of the attacks? Where does it happen? How many people are getting hit?
I mean, it mostly happens in townships. It happens in townships in two particular places in South Africa. It happened in KwaZulu. It started in Durban, which is on South Africa's east coast, which is the place where mostly it's a predominantly Zulu-speaking part of South Africa. That's the area that King Zwelithini claims as his kingdom. And then it moved also to inner city Johannesburg. So Johannesburg attracts most migrants from other parts of Africa. In fact, the downtown of Johannesburg, which had been sort of deserted after whites left it, and when black South Africans were reluctant to move there, mostly black Africans from other parts of the continent live in downtown Johannesburg. So those two became the flashpoints. And then finally, like other, you know, squatter areas, like in places of informal housing, those were the forms of kind of attacks that happened. People have been burned alive, stabbed. There's this infamous portrait that have been on front pages of newspapers where somebody's drawing a knife and stabbing a man that's lying on the ground, a Mozambican migrant. So that's the nature. It's, you know, it's like violence on people's person.
And aside from the King Zwelithini, are any other politicians, political figures encouraging this? Or are they playing to anti-immigrant sentiments, whipping them up?
There's two things. One, in the lead up to the statement by the king at the end of March, there were other South African politicians who were making xenophobic remarks, you know, saying things like, there was the minister, I think, of small business development, Lindiwe Zulu, who was actually a former ANC, a member of the ANC's military wing. She made a comment that in the language of South Africa, people from the rest of Africa are always foreigners. Whites are expats or immigrants. But anyway, she said that these foreigners must share their business expertise. It's time that they share their business expertise with South Africans. And then another minister made comments about how wherever you look, foreigners are running every spaza. And spaza, in sort of local, in a colloquialism, it basically means like a corner store. They're running every corner store. But there's a long history in South Africa of government officials making either ambiguous statements or explicitly xenophobic statements about other African migrants. Even Zuma, he has done nothing to repudiate Zwelithini. In fact, his main comments were to say, "These, you know, I can help you to leave the country." And then in a letter to a Mozambican writer, Miyakoto, he basically said, "You know, I'm sorry, but most of the crime is done by migrants." Subsequent to it, and I think this is always interesting in South Africa, after the sort of spectacular violence, what happens in South Africa is suddenly nobody is xenophobic. So there's suddenly all kinds of campaigns and marches because it's not necessarily that there's remorse. It's more that those same officials suddenly feel that South Africa is getting a bad name and that people are now questioning that sort of idea of this open rainbow nation, this very welcoming country. And so then suddenly everybody's against xenophobia, but there's almost like a cycle to it. Probably in a couple of months again, you'll start hearing some or other politician mouthing off against foreigners.
Now, I presume, not to excuse this, but I presume what's driving this is a high degree of unemployment, poverty, and general desperation, right?
No, this is true. I think this is why I think when this kind of violence happens in South Africa, what happens is there's like a sort of band-aid approach. Okay, let's have some marches. Let's say no to xenophobia. Let's, you know, everybody feels good about it. But what happens, what does not happen is that this is about the failures of the South African government, the failure of capital to deal with the sort of the crises that are like at the heart of this South African economy, which is that there's this massive unemployment. There's very little. There is investment in the public sphere, but it is mediated by corruption. There's a welfare system, but it does nothing except to sort of just barely keep people alive. It doesn't help people to sort of become, if you want, productive. It the only thing that it can do for them is to barely keep them alive. So there's, in South Africa, there's not an argument against welfare, but there's not enough to get people onto their feet. There's no discussion about like how did we get to this? Why do the townships still look like they looked 20 years ago? Those discussions don't come up in South Africa. Instead, they just become about bad apples. Let's get rid of bad apples. Yeah.
I'm speaking with Sean Jacobs, who teaches international affairs at the New School in New York. Now, you touched on this, but could you develop a bit? How has township life changed since apartheid fell?
I mean, one of the interesting things about post-apartheid South African life is that there's still, you know, we're retaining the inequalities between black and white. I mean, some of that has shifted. There's a new class of black people who enter the state, you know, civil service. There's a middle class. More and more people go to university. The actions you saw at the University of Cape Town around the people agitating for the statue of Cecil John Rhodes to fall, that's an indicator of that. But within the townships, of course, there is, you know, there's some kind of the emergence of a middle class where some people live in sort of, and there's always been that, live in better housing, houses that they own. But the bulk of the housing stock is government-owned, people renting from them, or there is increasing pressure on that housing stock because the government is not keeping up with building new housing. And so there's just sections of townships that consist of informal housing, squatter housing, or backyard squatting, where people live in backyards, or where there's at least like three families living or two families living in one two-bedroom house. So those are the things that this new government has not even tried to address.
What is the official policy towards immigration? Are these people here legally or not?
I mean, in general, the South African government says that it's really receptive to refugees from political people fleeing some kind of political persecution. So, for example, South Africa has a really good policy on Palestinian refugees. If you're a Palestinian refugee, you're welcome, regardless. You can just come, you know, Syrian refugees. Like, so there's certain classes of refugees that are allowed in South Africa. Oddly, they don't, they question always the claims of African refugees. So there's political refugees that came from Zimbabwe. Of course, some of these people are, you know, you can be, it's not exclusive, you're a political refugee, but sometimes you're also an economic refugee. Similarly, people from, you know, Congo, from the DRC, from parts of Nigeria, where there's sort of sectional or you know, all kinds of political violence, come to South Africa, but they're always second guessed. And right now, most recently, the South African government announced something called a border management plan, which is almost figuratively, they're saying they're going to build like a wall. They want to build a wall. They're not going to build a wall like, say, the one that the U.S. is trying to do with Mexico or is doing already in parts of the border. They are saying sort of like they would like to achieve something like that to keep people out. So officially, they're welcoming. But most migrants who are in South Africa, when you arrive, you get, you know, you can get a document if you're a refugee, if you're claiming some you know, fleeing from political upheaval. But it's very hard. Like at some point, people always complain of being in some kind of legal limbo, particularly African migrants.
I'm curious about how this relates to questions of South African identity. Is this part of a certain kind of nation building? And is there an ambivalence about being part of Africa among South Africans?
Right. Let me just, before I answer that, I was going to finish my, I just was reminded of another thought, which is one other thing the South African government does with African migrants is to round them up regularly and deport people on trains back to Zimbabwe and Mozambique. Of course, you know, people do come back, like say the next week. Also to do spot checks, like stopping people on the street. So if you're dark, basically there's this sort of myth that South Africans aren't very dark. And so they will just, I know people that have been stopped on the street and asked, you know, you're not South African, get arrested, and often end up in jail. So that's part of the sort of the way that policy works in the everyday. Also, the South African government is very hostile. Its embassies and consulates to other Africans always complain this in Nigeria or wherever that when they go down to the embassy, they feel it's worse than when they're trying to get a visa to come to the United States. If you could just, if I got your question earlier, which is like what this has to do with South African national identity. At the one that I think, as I said earlier, there is this problem when it comes to South African national identity. I think there's a lack of imagination, or it's a very conservative idea of who could be part of the nation. In a way, when you look at it at first, it looks kind of progressive because it means anybody who arrived here between, say, when the first whites arrived in 1652, the Dutch, when they, you know, then brought slavery to South Africa and kind of inaugurated sort of 150 years of extreme violence, either against the indigenous population or in the way that they treated the slaves who were mostly from West Africa or parts of the Indian Ocean. All those people in the current sort of idea of South Africa, all those people who arrived between 1652 or who were there And up until 1990, they have a right. So it could be these whites, it could be, you know, indented laborers from India, it could be the descendants of slaves, it could be the descendants of the indigenous people that they found there, or, you know, these various African nations, Zulu, Xhosa, etc., you know, Jewish migrants who, not migrants, but people fleeing pogroms in Russia, you know, at the end of the 19th century. All those people, immigrants from Europe, all those people have they can claim to be South African. That's I think, at the heart of it. But anybody else who comes after that, they can never be South African. So I think that's something that South Africa as a country will have to come to terms with. At the same time, and you pointed out to something else, which is South Africans are very schizophrenic about their relationship to the rest of Africa. So you can blame many things for that. You can blame apartheid, education, you know, apartheid's isolationist politics. Also, the ANC, despite the fact that it was in exile in Zambia and had you know, a lot of support from African governments, other African liberation movements, it was never a Pan-Africanist political movement. The closest thing in South Africa to a Pan-Africanist movement was the PAC, the Pan-Africanist Congress, which is a much smaller party that is heyday at the end of the 1950s and the beginning of the 1960s. So the ANC much more looked towards the Soviet Union as more third worlders rather than an African political movement. And then secondly, South Africans believe their own propaganda, which is that the rest of the continent, you know, is far behind them, doesn't look like South Africa. Yet any black South African township, if you've gone to any other place in Southern Africa or West Africa, they look like us, you know, where people live, looks very similar in their conditions. There is a sort of the way in which South Africa thinks of itself, like it's a relationship, say, that the United States has to Central America and the Caribbean. South Africans think about their own identity with other Africans in the same way. There's more money. It's a richer country. South African commerce, business, multinationals, they basically control markets, whether it's in construction or telecommunications in other parts of Africa. That doesn't mean that the population is rich, but they sort of, like the same way that Americans think that the wealth of corporations is their wealth, so I think South Africans think in the same way about their country and its relationship to the rest of the continent.
And is there any constructive way out of this, or is this just so deeply embedded in the structure of South Africa now that we're really facing years of this sort of thing?
I mean, I think at the level of popular culture, there's definitely better conversations and you know, music, musicians, filmmakers have attempted to get around this. Not in that sort of, like, you know, Kumbaya style or Egypt, you know, the pyramids and so on. Not that kind of politics, but really like real politics of people moving, of sort of understanding that there's migration is a natural fact of life. And secondly, also about re-educating South Africans, like whether it's, and this is not just like, hey, you were hosted by other countries politically, but that the South African economy had always been this kind of, you know, a multinational economy. You had, like, they've always relied on labor from elsewhere in whether it was Mozambique, whether it was the then Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia, the Congo, Malawi. There'd always been those workers were the people who worked on its mines. And then separately, so, a lot of black South Africans share, like, language, culture with other people in the sub-region. So Ndebele and Zulu and Xhosa, they are all part of what's called, like, the Nguni language. So there are all kinds of relationships with languages. Slavery had, you know, you can trace it back where people are the descendants of slaves from Mozambique, slaves from Angola that end up in the Cape Colony. So there's just all kinds of connections that people don't know about in South Africa. And then unfortunately, the ANC, as I said, who had this rich history of having camps in Angola, camps in Tanzania, having its main headquarters while it was in exile in Lusaka, in Zambia, having, you know, representatives in Nigeria, even Zuma himself, he spent a large section of his life up till now, he lived in either Mozambique, Swaziland, or Zambia, Angola even. And, you know, you don't get this kind of, that's not part of the public life in South Africa at the moment.
I was Sean Jacobs, Assistant Professor of International Affairs at the New School in Manhattan and founder of the Africa is a Country blog. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more of that Hugh Masekela song, Stimula. Till next week, Bye.
This is all by my life.